Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we have a dream. We'll give you a preview of WISO's Community Voices tribute to the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And Stephen Curtis is with Fairtax Ohio. He'll tell us about the work that organization is doing. Up first, the Ohio Department of Education released report cards for Ohio's schools this week. The 2013 report cards rate schools and buildings in the first 9 of 18 new performance criteria. The new assessment system features letter grades that the DOE says are more familiar to people. According to Ohio's top public schools official, Superintendent Richard Ross, no district received all A's or all F's, but in the first round of new scores, districts did fall at all points on the scale. Ross says tougher performance standards will make Ohio's schools better and the state more competitive. It was a mixed bag of results for schools in the Miami Valley. Dayton Public Schools received D's and F's in all 9 categories of assessment. In a communication to staff and teachers, Superintendent Lori Ward said the results were not positive and the school system must do better. No excuses. Trotwood Madison and Northridge Local Schools also received low scores under the new grading system, and many schools in the area received a range of scores, A through F, in the new categories. Kettering Schools topped the list with A's and B's in all categories, and Yellow Springs Schools received mostly A's and B's, some C's. The Ohio Department of Education released the data on a new interactive website. Members of the Ohio Senate Committee on Medicaid Health and Human Services and other health professionals from around the state met in Cincinnati Thursday to discuss Ohio's high infant mortality rate. State Senator Shannon Jones chairs that committee. I spoke to her by phone.
Just to give you a couple of statistics that I think paint a really vivid and bleak picture are, you know, from 2000 to 2010, our infant mortality rates have actually increased by about 3%. What's really startling, in my view, is that when you look at us in comparison to the rest of the nation, during that same period of time, the infant mortality rates across the nation have dropped by 11%. So the disparity between Ohio's infant mortality rate and the rest of the nation continues to grow. That disparity continues to grow.
What is believed to be behind the increase for Ohio?
Well, there's, as is the case with problems of this magnitude, it's complicated. There's a lot of factors, and we don't yet know a lot of the reasons. But some of them, you know, include a lack of education. So, for example, we've been told from the medical community and our mothers and grandmothers through the years that you place a baby on its stomach when you put a child to sleep. And we've learned now that that has been wrong information that we once thought was accurate. And so to re-educate people about that is really important, because in the state of Ohio, there are 3 babies a week that die as a result of the position that they've been placed in their crib, as well as the location of their sleep. So just that kind of education alone and focusing on trying to get that information out to people will certainly help save babies' lives. There's a whole sort of sundry of other things. You know, the committee is going to be examining some of the health disparities between Caucasian women in this state and African American women in this state. So, as it relates to other states, Ohio ranks 37th in infant mortality amongst white babies. But when you look at it as it related to African-American babies, that number drops to 49th in the country. And so there is a disparity between race, and we need to better understand why that is and try to tackle those challenges. There's a lot of complicating factors, but I think included in that is certainly things like access to regular medical care, but also, you know, the kind of care that individuals are receiving. So we need to understand that. You know, I think our focus has to be here in the state on looking at sort of evidence-based practices that's going to allow us to tackle this challenge. And, you know, the good news, there's a lot of exciting things happening around the state. You know, people are concerned about this. They are trying to, you know, find strategies that help in individual areas. I think the committee's objective is to understand what's really working based on the evidence and see if there's opportunities for us to assist to bring those strategies to scale to really tackle the problem.
What are some of the areas where you're bringing this evidence from? Certainly from the health industry, but who are some of the partners in this community roundtable?
Well, there are no shortage of people who are trying to tackle the problem, certainly. And so in Cincinnati, we're going to be looking to some of the health professionals in the community. We're going to the Price Hill Health Center, and they have developed some prenatal programs and other programs to really get these women before they deliver their children to try to ward off prematurity, because we know that prematurity is one of the leading causes of infant mortality. You know, the roundtable discussion is, you know, we're going to be looking at towards the health workers in this area who've been doing a lot of home visits with pregnant women and new moms to try to institute best practices to lower the infant mortality rate. So we're going to hear from the front lines to see what's working in the Cincinnati community. And then, of course, I don't think you can talk about the medical piece of infant mortality if you're not looking at some of the early childhood pieces as well. And so Cincinnati's got some really good programs like Every Child Succeeds that institute some of these home visiting, intensive home visiting models, so we can see what kind of success and measured success they have to look at maybe if there's some application on a statewide basis.
With your position on the Committee on Medicaid Health and Human Services, with regard to public policy, do you see some of the measures coming out of this roundtable heading towards legislative path or simply a marketing path to increase awareness?
Well, I don't think we want to exclude any of those options and maybe some others that we haven't yet identified. And so our visit to Cincinnati is the first of five, so we'll be going to all corners of the state to learn what different areas are doing, because their challenges are different in some communities. And so I hope that we can both advance the education among the community and the citizens of the state to be able to do those things that they can to prevent things like prematurity. You know, even there's some great programs out there that are educating the doctors, the obstetricians, about not scheduling deliveries before 39 weeks based on convenience. And so that has shown, you know, great results for very little cost. So I think the education piece is important. But I think, you know, we would not rule out opportunities to understand some best practices out there that might require some sort of legislative action. So we're open to what we learn on this tour. I'm really eager to spend some concentrated time with the committee around the state to really hear what's happening.
And you mentioned four additional meetings after this one. What's the time span?
We'll be in Columbus next week on the 29th, spending the day there, learning about some of their programs. Then we're also going to the Toledo and Lima. Dayton, we're going to be hitting on September the 26th. And then we'll be ending on October 3rd in the Cleveland area. And interspersed throughout that kind of two-month period of time, we'll be also taking some testimony in our standing committee in Columbus that reinforces, supports, and allows us to learn more about some of the things we're seeing out in the field. So it's going to be a pretty intensive two-month study of this issue.
Great. Any final comments?
Well, we're excited to learn. If there are people out there who have some special expertise and would like to have more information about any of the various field hearings, these certainly should contact my office. We'd be happy to invite them and give them any materials that we have. But we think it's going to be a great opportunity, so we look forward to hearing from the community.
I've been speaking with State Senator Shannon Jones. Senator, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
On Friday, WISO News Director Emily McCord spoke with Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles about more state issues for Ohioans.
It seems like there's something new every week with Jobs Ohio. We learned that the German company Rittal, that was headquartered in Urbana, is leaving the state, and it was one that received tax credits from Jobs Ohio. And Democrats in the State House are concerned that the governor is receiving deferred payments from another company that received Jobs Ohio assistance. What are Democrats doing about this?
Well, what they're concerned about is Governor Kasich, when he was running against Governor Strickland, he sat on a board, Worthington Industries, which is a huge company and has a lot of subsidiaries. One of the subsidiaries has received quite a bit of money from Jobs Ohio since the time Jobs Ohio was created. But when Governor Kasich was elected to office, he relinquished his seat on that board of Worthington Industries, but he took deferred compensation payments. And those deferred compensation payments have gone into this period of time when Jobs Ohio is actually in operation. So you've got on the books, you've got a governor who's being paid by a company, and that company is getting tax incentives and all kinds of things from Jobs Ohio. It doesn't look good. Now, the governor's people will point out, hey, it's deferred compensation, that anyone could get that money that qualified for it. It shouldn't matter if the governor is a friend or a foe of the company and that sort of thing. But Democrats keep pointing out the same thing that they've pointed out from the beginning, and that is that there is a lack of transparency in Jobs Ohio. So all of these things that have been put in place to keep the public from knowing a lot about Jobs Ohio, to keep the element of secrecy there, and then the stuff that comes out that you do know, that's what Democrats are pointing at. They're like, look, this doesn't look right. It doesn't pass the smell test. And the Republicans have passed laws that we can't go back in and find out what's going on. It's political for them.
Democrats are introducing a bill, at least, that'll be aimed at one part of Jobs Ohio. What was the story there?
The bill would require any future governor, or the governor from now on, and any future governor, they would have to relinquish seats on boards and that sort of thing, and they could not accept payments from private companies. This is something that would be put in place to kind of make it at least more palatable to the public, you know, to not have the at least perceived conflict of interest.
Will it matter? I know that the Democrats are largely outnumbered by the Republicans in the Ohio House.
Yeah, we asked that question, you know, where's this going to go? And the sponsors of it say, well, the Republicans should be on board with this because they should want to know this, too. And, there could be a Democratic governor that comes along at some point. And don't you want this in place? But I mean, realistically, Emily, it's not going to catch on until Republicans start talking about this and getting concerned about it. But right now, it just doesn't appear real likely.
I want to ask you about another bill that's in the legislature, and that's one that would prevent students who are immigrants from getting in-state tuition. The Ohio Chancellor, the Ohio Board of Regents just recently allowed that to happen, and now some Republicans want to overturn that. What's behind that move?
Well, it goes back to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's a federal program. And what it is kids who were brought into this country who had no say of being here. You know, they might have been 6 months old, a year old. Their parents brought them here illegally, but they've been raised in this country. They've been raised in Ohio. They've gone to Ohio K-12 schools. They are still were charged an international rate to go to Ohio's public colleges before the chancellor made this change. Now, some Republicans in the Ohio legislature say, hey, wait a minute. We don't like the fact that the chancellor is now allowing these students to take advantage of in-state rates. And they want to take away that opportunity for that to be offered to these students. the activists who are representing these students point out is that these students are taxpayers. They live here. They are here legally. They have paperwork to be here. And that even though they may have the federal rule will give them the chance to attend college, apparently it's about three times the rate of an in-state student. And they say that keeps a lot of students who are in this situation from being able to go to college.
I've been speaking with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Stephen Curtis is the State Director of Fairtax Ohio. He recently stopped by the WYSO studios to talk about the work the organization is doing to raise awareness of tax issues facing all Americans.
Well, basically, we're here to, one, help people understand what the fair tax is and why it's so important to them. When folks realize what the fair tax means to them or could mean to them, almost everybody we talk to becomes a strong supporter and advocate of it. Probably the most important thing to realize is we've had a tax system, the income tax system, for over 100 years. And during that time, it's never really worked very well. If you look at it, since 86 alone, we've had more than 27,000 modifications to the tax system trying to fix problems. And what the fair tax does is it eliminates the federal income tax, the payroll tax, the business taxes, the alternative minimum tax, and all other federal income taxes, and replaces them with a single, simple retail sales tax. So you keep your whole paycheck. Every penny you earn is yours to keep, and then you pay your taxes when you make your purchases of new goods and services. In addition, under the fair tax, nobody pays a penny in taxes until they've taken care of themselves and their family. So any taxes you pay on purchases up to the poverty level end up being refunded to you in what we call the prebate, which is just kind of a term of art indicating you get the money back every month, and then it compensates you for the taxes you're going to be paying in that following month.
Okay. So it's a tax based on consumption.
It's a consumption tax. In other words, the more you spend above the poverty level, the more you pay in taxes. And in that respect, it's actually progressive because the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts of the world, they buy a lot of new stuff. And as such, they pay a lot in taxes. You and I, on the other hand, we may not buy a new car every year. We would pay relatively little in taxes.
And so what's the greatest misunderstanding about this fair tax that people have in your estimate?
Well, there's a couple of them. One is that it's an additional tax. Many people don't realize that we're eliminating a whole host of federal income taxes and replacing them with the fair tax. So it's a replacement. It's not a in addition to. And in some cases, that misunderstanding is deliberately fostered by some people who oppose the fair tax. So it's easy to understand why it's happening. Another common misconception is that the price of everything will go up substantially under the fair tax. And again, that's not the case because under the fair tax, all the taxes that are already embedded in goods and services disappear. And studies have shown that amounts to around 20% of the cost of everything you buy. So under the fair tax, that 20% disappears and then roughly 23% goes back on. So for new goods and services, the price would go up by, say, 5% or so. But you would have your whole paycheck. So for the average worker, that means they get about between 15 and 25% more money every week, and they pay another 5% or 10% on the goods and services that they buy, the new goods and services. So it's really a pretty good deal in that respect.
The fair tax effort is a nationwide effort. You're involved with the state of Ohio.
It is a nationwide effort. This is a repeal of the federal income taxes. Now, there are many states that have looked at the success of places like Florida and Texas and seen how well they do without an income tax, and they're moving in that direction. Ohio happens to be one of them. If you've noticed, our governor recently reduced our income taxes and increased our sales taxes because, again, it fits the model of the consumption tax, which is a more efficient, less onerous way of collecting necessary monies for the operation of government.
What's the biggest resistance from legislators on this?
Power. The fact of the matter is many members of Congress have a tremendous amount of power in terms of lobbyist campaign contributions, in terms of companies, corporations coming to them and saying, oh, please, please give us a break on our taxes and we'll do all kinds of good things for you. So the tremendous power that the income tax system gives, shall we say, some of our less ethical members of Congress is simply unbelievable. The fair tax, on the other hand, is totally different. There is one rate, everybody pays it on all new goods and services. So it doesn't matter whether you're Bill Gates with billions of dollars, you can't buy something cheaper under the fair tax than Jerry Kenney, because there's only one rate and it's for everybody. And Congress can't change it for Bill Gates without changing it for you and I.
How long has the fair tax movement been around?
It's been around since the early 90s. It started really very small, just a few people getting together and saying there has to be a better way to do it. And spent several years researching it. We spent over $25 million, almost $26 million now, doing research to discover what the best form of taxation was and what the best way of implementing that form would be. So the fair tax has got more research, more study, more analysis behind it than any other piece of tax legislation that has ever come before Congress. And it is before Congress. It's there right now as H.R. 25. Unfortunately, it's being buried in committee because the leadership and many of the folks in Congress don't want to see it, don't want the American people to know it's there, because they recognize what they, the members and the leadership of Congress, stand to lose if the American public realizes what an advantage the fair tax would be.
And in the time that the fair tax movement has been underway, what headway do you see has been made?
Oh, we've made tremendous headway. Not only do more people know about the fair tax as part of our education efforts, we have 70-some co-sponsors in the House right now. These are members of Congress who have looked at the fair tax, they have listened to their constituents, and they said, yeah, this is what America needs. One of the things I didn't mention, the fair tax would create 10 million jobs. So the, 14 million people we have on unemployment right now, those people would have jobs. The fair tax by itself would essentially return the United States to a full employment country once again.
Can you explain a little bit about where those jobs would come from as a result of this?
Well, because of our income tax system, we've lost 1.5 million jobs due to imports, because the current income tax system actually subsidizes foreign goods coming into the country to compete with American manufacturers. We've lost 3.5 million due to exports, because when American goods are exported, they have to keep the cost of the taxes built into the product, which is an unfair advantage for foreign businesses when we try and export to their country. One of the studies that was done showed that many foreign companies would move either their manufacturing or their entire headquarters to the U.S. There was a study done of 500 Japanese corporations. 400 of them said they would move their next manufacturing facility to the U.S. if we pass the fair tax. The other 100 said they would reincorporate as an American business and move their entire headquarters and staff to the United States if we pass the fair tax. There's also more than $13 trillion currently being kept out of the United States, either by American companies or by foreign companies who keep it in banks because they have no place to invest it, that would flow into the United States if we did away with our 35% corporate tax rate and replaced our tax system with the fair tax.
We talked about legislators and maybe their hold on power as being a reason for resistance of this effort. Any other groups fighting this?
Folks like H&R Block. And I don't want to pick on them particularly, but they're an example of people who live off the current income tax system. You have, surprisingly, many of the big box stores and their associations don't like the idea of the fair tax, because under the fair tax, the poor in particular have more money in hand, so they can pay cash for their products. They don't have to buy them on credit. If they don't buy them on credit, the stores don't end up with the interest payments that makes them so much money. Any economist will tell you that buying on credit from a big box store is one of the worst things you can do for your budget. And the fair tax actually helps people escape from poverty, unlike the current income tax system, which effectively works to keep people held in economic bondage.
And just as we talked about who might be against the system, I'm particularly interested in who are you getting help from?
We've got several legislators who have expressed support. We don't have any co-sponsors. It's a little disappointing. Several of the folks we've talked to have said, gee, I really like the fair tax, but I don't want to go on record. And I'll be very honest with you. We're getting to the point now as a movement where we're saying, you're either supporting the fair tax or you're not. You know, we've been to this dance before, and we appreciate whatever position you may be in. But the fact of the matter is, we either need people in Congress who will fight for the fair tax and help us get it in, or we need to find people who will.
I've been speaking with Stephen Curtis, State Director of Fair Tax Ohio. Stephen, thanks so much for the information today.
Enjoyed it.
We end today's show with a couple of programming notes you don't want to miss. First, here's a few words from WISO General Manager Nina Ellis.
The jazz pianist Marion McPartland died this week at age 95. Tuesday night, WISO's Dave Barber will pay tribute to McPartland with special programming beginning at 8 p.m. 25 years ago, I spent a day with Marion McPartland. She was a guest on a radio program that I worked on in Minnesota. During rehearsal, she chatted with the other musicians on the program like an old friend. And that night, after the show, we took her out to dinner. In the front of the restaurant, there was a grand piano, a player piano, cranking out a tune without a musician at the keyboard. I thought she'd be upset, but no. She stood for a moment, watching the keys move by themselves, and exclaimed, "It's Teddy! It's Teddy Wilson!" She not only knew the tune, she recognized the player whose performance had been transcribed. She was gracious and funny and unflappable. I hope you will tune in on Tuesday night at 8 p.m. during Dave Barber's Jazz Night as he pays tribute to the incomparable Marion McPartland.
This week, WYSO celebrates the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington with a special production of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. For the project, WYSO brought together a diverse cross-section of members from Dayton and Yellow Springs communities to visit our studios and put their voices to this historic speech. Some of the voices you'll hear were at the march on August 28, 1963. We Have a Dream is a Community Voices collaboration, and you can hear it in its entirety on Excursions with Nikki Dakota this coming Wednesday. Here's part of what you'll hear.
I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
I still have a dream.
I have a dream.
Aujourd'hui, je rêve.
I still have a dream.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Rooted in the American dream.
Es un sueño profundamente enraizado en el sueño americano.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
I have a dream that one day, out in the red hills of Georgia,
the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood.
I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin,
but by the content of their character.
I have a dream today.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification,
that one day, right down in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers.
I have a dream today.
Celebrate the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech Wednesday on Excursions on WYSO. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all our guests. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.